Brooke Benton, Dinah Washington, you got what it takes. All right. When we come back, we will go back to the Barker Ranch. This is where the Manson family retreated after their horrific killing spree at the Tate LaBianco house back in 1969. And we will meet a quite a remarkable man who will tell us about quite a remarkable dog, Buster, Charlie Manson, and the corpse-sniffing dog. All of that upcoming right here on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Dosti is a retired Mammoth Lakes police sergeant. He's working to bring attention to what has become a personal mission to help bring home America's soldiers still missing in action. It's a mission he came to after a series of events that began in Mammoth Lakes when Dosti began training his dog Buster as an avalanche rescue dog up on Mammoth Mountain ski area. One thing led to another, and Dosti grew fascinated with the world of forensic research. He trained Buster as a cadaver dog. Then a homicide case in Mammoth Lakes near Shady Rest led to more contacts in the world of forensic research. It was then that he decided to train Buster to do something more than a simple cadaver dog. And since then, Buster and Dosti investigated the Barker Ranch, where the Charles Manson family reportedly went following the Tate LaBianca murder killing spree of 1969. After Buster had alerted on several spots at Barker Ranch, Dosti and others were left to believe there were human remains buried there. Paul Dosti, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm fine, Richard. Thanks for having me on your show tonight.
It's a pleasure. And first of all, we should begin with some sad news. We've been talking about this amazing creature, Buster, whom I met in Death Valley just about a month ago. And give us an update on Buster.
Well, Buster passed away here on the 26th of February, and he was 12 years, 2 months old, and he just collapsed while he was playing. So I was with him when he left us.
That must have been devastating.
Very devastating.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss, and I only got to meet Buster for just a few short minutes, but I could tell that he was well-loved, and what a life he had, a real hero.
Yeah, you know, he's traveled all over the world, and, you know, with the group, the MIA group, we work with History Flight, and he's had opportunities that no dog in the world has ever had, and working in France, Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, and, of course, on Tarawa, where he's had the majority of his finds.
Well, let's take a few moments and describe what actually a cadaver dog is and how a cadaver dog is trained.
Well, typically, Buster is more like a forensic dog than a cadaver dog, because the typical cadaver dog is finds soft tissue decomposition, and we specialize in grave work, and they usually belong to a search and rescue team, so any dog will do. But what happens in clandestine and unmarked grave detection, particularly with the older sites, the scent, or which we call Volta organic compounds, can be in the low parts per trillion and possibly parts per quadrillion. And that's where the average search and rescue dog just doesn't have the detection ability. And because they use the theory in search and rescue is to have a small dog that you can carry out of the backcountry if it's injured. And for grave work, you need a big dog with a big nose that has the genetic predisposition for scenting. And there's a study out of Europe and where they're trying to figure out why the Labradors and the German Shepherds are the best scenting dogs, and they identified these specific genetic markers. So he is a big Labrador with a big head and a big nose. And as Dr. Arpad Vass, my forensic anthropologist friend, says, a big nose is better and a big wet nose is best, because that's what's going to trap those VOCs.
All right, let's now I think most of us know already that dogs have an amazing sense of smell. I've read reports where dogs are able to sniff out cancerous tumors and alert someone that they have cancer before they even know it. But you just said something there that is astounding. And we'll discuss what this compound is that they're actually smelling. But you say parts per quadrillion is all that's needed? Parts per quadrillion?
We believe that. When I started working with Dr. Vass, who obtained his PhD from the Body Farm there at the University of Tennessee, but he's a special type of forensic anthropologist in that he's not a bone guy, he's a chemistry guy. And so he has studied and wrote four peer-reviewed, published scientific papers on the chemistry of human decomposition, which is what he got his PhD in. So we look for, there's over 450 documented volatile organic compounds that are a result of human decomposition. And what I mean by that is we're talking about the microbes working on the remains and producing these chemicals. And layman's term would be that the microbes eat the remains and poop out these chemicals. So some of these chemicals would be very familiar to you, like carbon tetrachloride, toluene, acetone, chloroform. These are all products of human decomposition. Some are actually carcinogens. But in low concentrations, they're difficult to detect, particularly when they're under the ground. And Buster's just had an incredible ability and we believe has the most documented recoveries, and I'm talking documented where a report was written, not they alerted somewhere and they think someone's there, of right around 250. And his really biggest find was on Tarawa. It was a trench burial of U.S. Marines, including a missing Medal of Honor winner, and that was 36. However, it looks like that's going to go up over 40 now.
So you and Buster traveled to what was the Pacific Theater during the Second World War to this island. And what year was this battle?
It was in November of 1943, in 76 hours, from November 20th to November 23rd. About 6,000 people died on 285 acres.
My word. And this was, we're probably talking about hand-to-hand combat at this point. I mean...
Oh, yeah, it was...
pretty gruesome.
It was gruesome. There was probably about 4,800 Japanese and 1,200 Marines, but the Marine casualties were underreported because, to pay that kind of price for this little, a small little piece of real estate like that was really, the American public couldn't handle it. And our information is probably more like 1,500.
So you traveled over there with Buster. Now, at whose behest did you do that?
We work with a group called History Flight, and you can look at historyflight.com or History Flight on Facebook. And that is the MIA group that I volunteer with. So all expenses are paid. And then, had a couple conditions. And going into the Third World, with my best friend, veterinarian with us. And then, of course, we have to have an air-conditioned car, an air-conditioned room, which we had because it's really hot. It's 80 miles from the equator. And it's a long trip. From LAX to Fiji is like 13 hours. And he's in the plane. He's really good. He holds it. And the other thing is he's not allowed to fly in the hold. He either flies in the cabin or we don't go. And that was a monumental task to get a big, 85-pound dog on a commercial flight that's not a United States plane. It was Fiji Air, Pacific Air at the time. And it really took, at every step of the way, I thought I was going to get turned around. It wasn't going to happen. But we finally made it over there. And after it was very stressful getting over there and being in quarantine in Fiji. And we finally, we put us in a concrete cell, and I stayed in the concrete cell with him. And, during the layover, and then finally the veterinarian convinced them to let them stay in the air-conditioned their lab where they process samples and stuff. So after that, we were able to stay where it's air-conditioned, but I never leave his side, ever.
And we're talking about a battle that took place 73 years ago.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know how decomposition works, how quickly it works, but I'm guessing there wouldn't be much left but bone fragments in many cases.
That's absolutely right, Richard. If you look at Dr. Vass's most recent peer-reviewed paper on the subject, it really shows how the chemistry changes through time. So many of these chemicals are transient. For instance, you'll never see carbon tetrachloride more than 2 years after death, and that one's gone. Some of them are transported. Some of them, but after about 40 or 50 years, the soft tissue decomp chemicals are gone, and now we have, I like to call bone decomposition. It's a specific chemical profile. Once they learn that, then they'll find stuff, 1,000 years old if there's bone. In fact, that's a big problem for us here in California as the Native American sites, that, prehistoric American Native American sites. So once they learn that, they'll find it. And so that was the way I taught him that, is that, again, working with Dr. Vass, we got a lot of samples from these old ghost town sites where there's really no one around. So we got a soil sample about a foot down. And we got this chemical profile, and that's what this paper, his most recent paper, is primarily based on time of death by chemistry, and that's what his initial PhD was in. But we've taken it, you know, light years ahead. So working with the dog was really helpful. And so when I take soil sample from an old grave, and it's 100 plus years old, so I know everything's there, and that's what I use as my training aid to train Buster on to find those graves.
And in the case of this battlefield, were you able to match human remains to identify them? Were the dog tags present? How did you do that?
Yeah, if you go to historyflight.com, I think you have our report, the Nielsen report, which details this trench burial. But yeah, quite often these guys are buried. I'm never there. My job is reconnaissance. So what took Buster about 2 minutes took the anthropologists and archaeologists 3.5 months to excavate. You know, we're recovering Americans, and so it's, you know, the old paint, brush, and trowel routine. And then, you know, basically it's, you know, 3 or 4 days to recover one guy when you take him to the lab, clean up the bones, and do everything. But they have the gear on. They have grenades. They have their webbing gear, you know, with, you know, like there was a BA, our guy, he had a big belt full of BAR magazines. He's obviously a BAR man, and which is the Browning automatic rifle from World War II. It was a 20-round magazine.
So you essentially point them in the right direction. You find the grave, and they do the digging.
Well, we find that Buster will find where the decomposition is, and on Tarawa, it's usually right where he alerts. Then we bring in our geophysics. Ground penetrating radar is the primary tool, and they will usually line up quite well. But you just can't get the guy from the local road department in their radar for bridges. We use archaeogeophysicists. So these guys are looking for they have special training. They have special software to interpret that data called geoslicing. And so all that science lines up, and we can do the chemistry too. But now we don't even do the chemistry anymore on Tarawa because Buster's just been 100%. And so we bring in our geophysics, and, you know, it could be off a little bit, you know, because it'll flow on the surface to a low spot. But they'll scan a big area. So a minute of work Buster can be several days for the geophysics guys. And then we do an evaluation. You know, there's a lot of investigation going into it. But the really neat thing about this site, is we call it Cemetery 27, is that I did the investigation that led us to that site. And I'm kind of an out-of-box guy, so I was used to some out-of-the-box techniques. At the same time, the deputy chief of intelligence, a really good guy at the Joint Personnel and Accounting Command there, he was assigned the same investigation, he told me. I had met him, and he said, hey, that was a great job. I was assigned that, too. But I didn't have any government resources, so I went about it a little different way.
And so in essence, what you're doing is you're finding these MIAs. These are MIAs for the last 73 years in this case. And
now, the Battle of Tarawa was just the worst handling of American war dead in the Second World War. And there's more missing Americans in one spot, you know, particularly on this little island, than really there is anywhere else. And, you know, there's 78,000 missing from World War II. There's about, I think, 1,500 from Vietnam. So wow. The World War II missing have been largely ignored, and the majority of the resources, over 90% of the resources have gone to 1% of the missing when it comes to MIAs.
Tell me about your work and Buster's work at the Battle of the Bulge. I mean, this is the scene of one of the bloodiest battles the Americans faced in the Second World War in December, January 44, 45 in France, Belgium, Luxembourg. Some 19,000 U.S. Killed, U.S. soldiers killed. So you took Buster over there, and what did you find?
Well, we have 7 recoveries there, and they were airmen. And it's a complex place. It's interesting because we have some Belgian colleagues that literally know the Ardennes force, where much of this battle took place, if you've ever seen in the old movies, like the back of their hand. But it's complex. We have an Almuthen, Belgium. It was a plane crash. It was a B-26, one of many that was shot down. And it was a huge crash crater. We eventually found it. a couple of the bombs, one or two of the 1,000 pound bombs went off when they hit. They were hit by German AAA. And so anyhow, this plane went down and exploded, and there was a crash crater. It was about 5 feet of water, 3 feet of mud. And so Buster alerted on the crash crater big time and then on this opposing hillside. And after they drained the water, we had a mini excavator there and then started processing the mud, the 3 feet of mud. The only thing that was found was half a tibia. So Buster found that half a tibia under 3 feet of mud and 5 feet of water.
That's remarkable. And
then the hillside was just covered with alerts, and those were, it took them another 3 or 4 months. You know, the JPAC had to come in and did a great job, very, in digging that whole hillside up, and they had enough for 6 funerals. They had dog tags and, you know, all types of equipment and things. There was 50 cal rounds all over the place, you know, that had cooked off when the thing crashed, and, you know, a lot of, pieces. You know, most of the plane had been scrapped out long ago, but these other parts were around.
And you're bringing closure to, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of families, or the survivors or the descendants.
Yeah, the sister of one of the crewmen, I believe he was a door gunner on that B-26, had, you know, begged the government to go bring her brother back, and she came. She flew out to Belgium with a priest, and they had a service at the site. I wasn't there when that took place.
How did you train a Buster to do this? Tell me about your early history with Buster.
Well, initially we trained at Avalanche, which is a really fun thing for the dogs because you bury people in the snow, and I think I may have sent you a video on that. And so, you know, I don't know how they do it, but part of the thing around Avalanche, there's a lot of people working at probe lines. And so what 80 people in a probe dine can do, a good Avalanche can dog, you know, they take them half hour, the dog can probably nail it in 5 or 10 minutes. It's just amazing how quickly they work. But what I never have been able to understand, you got the scent of, you know, 50, 60, 80 people on a probe line. How do they pick out that one snip that's only coming from underneath the snow and ignore all those other ones? And I've seen them work right in front of a probe line and just no alerts. And, you know, everyone has their own scent. So there's a lot of mysteries. We don't know how they do it, but it's pretty incredible. But the other thing is, you have to look at the dog as a machine, in a way, is that it's a hardware-software thing. The hardware is the nose that gathers the data, and then the brain processes it. And they do that very quickly. 40% of their brain is devoted to interpreting the data collected by the nose. And so if a medium-sized dog, if you were to, there's folds in there that capture these VOCs, and it would be the size of about an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, the surface area and size of the nose of a medium-sized dog. But then there's that genetic thing, and the Labradors, obviously, they're made for finding ducks, but you get the least amount of off-gassing in cold weather, and hot weather you get more off-gassing. So they're just bred to find, ducks or whatever you want to trade them for in the most difficult circumstances, which is why they work so well. And the other thing for us is that we go to a third world country. We are ambassadors, and I cannot have a dog that will bite anybody. So, you know, we can't tell people clear the streets where the Americans, you know, get out of here. We have to work with it. So typically there'll be a crowd of anywhere from 15 to 30 children that'll run right next to him as he's working, and he ignores them. And it's like the circus came to town. This is, you know, they don't have TVs or anything over there. This is a very poor nation, and so we have it's an incredible experience going to the third world with an American dog, and getting them over there.
It's Paul Dosti, who's a retired sheriff with Mammoth Lakes, and he's talking about his amazing dog, Buster, who just passed away a couple of weeks ago. I met Paul in Death Valley National Park, and I had a very brief meeting with Buster, a lovely dog. We will eventually circle back to the Barker Ranch. That's where this is all headed, and if you want to come along for the ride, then you need to keep it tuned right here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast's Las Vegas affiliate, KXNT. Stay with us. Say hi on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S as in Simon, Y because I love you, R-E-T-T, Richard Serrett, at Richard Serrett. And you can listen to my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show, out of Toronto, Canada, on Zoomer Radio. And that's Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. That's live. Or you can listen to the live stream at zoomerradio.ca or download my free app, The Conspiracy Show, and listen to it live or listen to previous episodes. That's The Conspiracy Show, Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. We are talking with Paul Dotze about his remarkable sniffer dog, Buster, who passed away, sadly, a couple of weeks ago at the ripe old age of 13. Really a hero, Buster is. And we'll get back to that in a moment, but I just wanted to crib here from an article that's in an online publication called thesheetnews.com. It's an article by Lara Kirchner in the Arts and Life section. Questions still surrounding Manson family hangout. The haunting face of Charles Manson is a tough thing to shake from your memory, even if you've only seen it over a television screen. The thought that there may be murders he orchestrated back in his heyday that are unaccounted for is something even harder to digest. In 2008, the Inyo County Sheriff's Department and the National Park Service authorized a dig at the Barker Ranch, the hangout where the Manson family reportedly went following the Tate-LaBianca murder spree of 1969. The dig was authorized following the request of scientists and now-retired Mammoth Lake Police Sergeant Paul Dotze, whose dog, a black Labrador named Buster, is trained to search for human remains. Buster had alerted on several spots at Barker Ranch, leaving Dotze and others to believe that there were human remains buried there. At the time of the dig in May 2008, the government agencies only authorized digging to depths of 3 to 4 feet. Nothing was found. But the questions on many people's lips since that time has been, did they dig deep enough? And wouldn't someone like Charlie Manson know how deep a body has to be buried? We'll discuss with Paul Dotze when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Welcome back to Coast. Paul Dotze is with us, retired Mammoth Lakes police sergeant who is working to bring attention to what's become a personal mission to help bring home America's soldiers still MIA. It's a mission he came to after a series of events that began in Mammoth Lakes when Dotze began training his dog Buster as an avalanche rescue dog up on Mammoth Mountain ski area. And then one thing led to another. Dotze grew fascinated with the world of forensic research, and he trained Buster as a cadaver dog. Now, we've been talking about your work in various battlegrounds. How did you get involved with the Manson family murders, and how did you get invited to Barker Ranch?
Well, actually, that was Buster's very first search in his entire career was the Barker Ranch, and that took place on February 24th, 2007. And an Inyo County deputy who I knew several years before told me that there was an author who's since deceased, Mr. Nelson. I don't remember his first name. Had an informant who was connected to the Manson family, said he knew where there was bodies buried up there. And that guy was Larry Melton. And so they went up there, and he said, okay, dig here behind the house. And they dug, didn't find anything. Well, Melton didn't join the family till afterwards. And he ran for mayor of the city of Berkeley on the Free Charlie Manson ticket. He didn't win. He's a kook. But what's interesting is that he was really embedded with the Manson family and after, you know, the arrests and everything. So he knew something. And the reason, he knew there was a body near the house because there's actually two, about 60 feet from the house on the side there. He just didn't know the location, but I think he knew where it was. And then he kind of went off his rocker and said, you guys didn't treat me with respect, so I didn't tell you the exact spot. But he just didn't know the exact. I don't think anyone told him the exact spot. But, you know, the key here, Richard, is there are eyewitnesses to the murders of the Barker Ranch. We have not spoken to them, but we have spoken to the people who they talked to after the murders. And the reason why is we need a competent law enforcement agency to interview. It has to be a clean interview so they can't accuse us of setting them up. but we have that, and as well as other murders. There's one in Olancha, Carl Stubbs, an elderly man who was murdered by Tex Watson, and two of the girls who I don't know, and a witness identified him. And so all this stuff has been ignored. Inyo County has ignored the Manson family for over 40 years. And I would also say the mass spectrometer chemistry of looking at these entire profiles by Dr. Vass, it's the same as the Barker Ranches where we're recovering Marines on Tarawa. The science is indisputable. And I noticed that I read the Coast to Coast Wikipedia thing, and whoever wrote it said, well, they never use peer-reviewed papers, you know, and, you know, junk science, all this stuff. Well, there are four peer-reviewed published papers on the science by Dr. Arpad Vass from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. So the science is indisputable. They limited the dig to 3.5 feet to make it go away.
Why? That's why they did it, to make it go away. I was going to ask, why would they only limit? I mean, surely, and as it points out in the as Laura Kirkner points out in this article, surely they would know how deep to bury a body to ensure that it wouldn't be easily discovered.
Yeah, well, I can tell you this, that's exactly right. And keep in mind that Susan Atkins is reported to have said, there's two boys and a girl buried at the Barker Ranch 8 feet deep. And interestingly enough, as you know, and your readers or your listeners don't know, I've developed a very good relationship with Manson.
Yes. let me just interject for 1 second, because right after you and I had lunch, the first thing you did, you took me out to your truck and you introduced me to Buster. And then you pulled out some letters from Charlie Manson himself. And I got to tell you, that just sent a chill up my spine.
Yeah, and I have about 200 recorded phone conversations with him. He calls the house, and I gave you one of those. And that particular phone conversation was when I basically asked him to help out where the bodies are. And he says, you know, I'm not a snitch. I don't tell on people. But he doesn't say there's no bodies. He's never really lied to me. There's stuff that I thought he was lying, but I'm on the computer. He says, hey, that judge that convicted me killed 17 people. What are you talking to me for? Judge Older. I go, really? And he goes, yeah, they're all Japanese. Well, it turns out Judge Older, at his trial, flew with the Flying Tigers in World War II and had 16 or 17 Japanese planes he shot down. So, you know, what's interesting is he'll say this crazy stuff, and, of course, you have a computer to check it out, because he's absolutely telling the truth. So he's never lied. But I've also been able to get into a lot of his supporters and everything. They've been actually pretty nice. And when Buster got cancer, we haven't talked about that, but he did. He found all those Marines and worked all over the Ardennes on three legs. They had amputated from a cancer. So just an amazing dog. But when he did get cancer, two very close friends of Manson who I knew called me and, you know, gave their condolences, and they said, they both told me, they're both, one's in Europe and one's in back east, and they both told me the same thing when they talked to Manson. And he used to say, that dog's trying to get me the death penalty. and I had sent Manson an aerial view, a Google Earth view of the Barker Ranch and marked the sites, and he knows exactly what's going on.
Well, let me ask you on a personal note, how it feels when you're receiving phone calls at your house from this man, you're corresponding, and I understand, you know, you're kind of playing a cat and mouse game with him. I think you even said you sent him a birthday card. Just, you know, you got to keep things kind of, you got to keep those lines of communication open. But it must give you kind of how does it make you feel corresponding with this guy?
Well, I correspond with another serial killer who's actually given me a bunch of sites, and we found them. I think you just compartmentalize it in your head. All that bad stuff, you know, is there. You know, kind of put it in a box. You know what's in the box, but you just don't open it. Just talk to him like a regular guy. And I've always done that when I talk to people. And he'll joke around, just like you and I could joke around. Be the same way with Manson. He'll joke around. Sometimes he'll get really silly and stuff. But he's very, very street smart. And my first conversation with him, I tried to, you know, work the angle. Remember, his big thing is Atwa, air, trees, and water. And so I said, you know, I got the sheriff. He hates my dog and the whole thing because he's anti-law enforcement. He likes animals and everything. And that's the tact I took. I thought I was being pretty smart. And he goes, let me tell you something, Paul. When I was 4 years old, my mother went to prison, which is true. they put me in an orphanage. And some people took me home to see if I could live with them. But they had this Cocker Spaniel, and every time I got close to them, this Cocker Spaniel would growl at me. Then they took me back because I wouldn't get close to them. And then I went to reform school and to prison. So that's how fast he thought. Now, you think if you analyze that, what he's saying is the dog thing, he could just say, the dog thing, animal thing ain't going to work with me. But he doesn't do that. He comes up with a story that's largely true, if not all true. And he says, in summary, I ain't going to buy into this dog thing because a dog ruined my life.
Right.
That's
right.
How smart he is, and that's how quick he is.
So, what is it going to take to get the authorities back to Barker Ranch to do a proper dig?
Well, we've been down this road with them, and they're fighting a tooth and nail. I mean, if they hear I'm working, the sheriff's department hears I'm working, in another agency or anywhere in California, they'll call them up and just ruin me. And this is it's incredibly unprofessional. But it's hard to talk scientific principles with people that barely have a high school education, and are now the sheriff, and so that's difficult to deal with. But I don't know. I think that with our record, you have my PowerPoint. I think the evidence is overwhelming.
Yes.
There's witnesses that have never been interviewed, and we've gone other routes. We went to I've done FOIA requests with the Park Service for all their emails between them and the sheriff. So I got 3,000 pages of FOIA. And so, which is a joke. People don't know that after the Patriot Act destroyed FOIA. It gave all these exemptions. And one of the exemptions is in different words, but essentially if there's something that can embarrass the government, they can redact it. So I got 3,000 pages of redacted emails and everything. There's some of them are duplicates, so it's probably closer to 2,000. All the stuff between them. So then you appeal to the Park Service, like that's your appeal process. So that's kind of like asking Frank Nitti to snitch off Al Capone.
Right.
And so they go, let me think about it. No, they want to redact everything. And the redactor is this gal named Cheryl Chipman, who's the FOIA person for Death Valley National Park. And she thinks it's pretty funny. I met her once. We were joking around. So I said, anyhow, then the next thing is to go to NARA, like the National Archives. It's a non-binding arbitration. So they call up the Park Service and go, pretty pleased with sugar on top. Can you unredact everything? They go, let me think about it. No. And so then you can go to court, federal court, and you will get, if you have an attorney, in federal court, the judge will probably give you that because it's not a national interest or anything. But, I'm one retired guy. I don't have the money to go to federal court in Fresno, which would be the federal court. But if there's ever an attorney who wants to make a name for himself, that's a big one. The other thing, Richard, that many of your listeners don't know about is the Manson tapes. This is an incredible story.
These were uncovered by Deborah Tate, right? These were the ones uncovered by the sister of Sharon Tate, one of the victims.
No, they were uncovered by Tom O'Neill. Deborah, Tom, and I are all friends.
Okay.
And, Deborah goes to all the parole hearings.
Right.
And testifies there, as her mother and sister did before her. She's a great lady. And so in 2008, in December, Tom calls me on the cell phone. I was actually coming back from a search in San Bernardino where a body was found. And he said, I just talked to the attorney for Tex Watson. This was his attorney was Bill Boyd down in Texas. So you may recall Tex Watson was tried separately from all the other members, because he fled to Texas from the Barker Ranch. And then they had to extradite him. And his cousin was the sheriff, and it took a while to make that happen before they extradite him. But anyhow, so Bill Boyd recorded about 20 hours of tape recordings with Watson about everything. And there's 6 hours of tape recordings he had. And Tom had consensually recorded this conversation with Bill Boyd, so that's not in dispute.
And Watson didn't implicate himself at all.
We don't know what's on the tapes, but he said, the lawyer, Bill Boyd, said, Tex told me about a bunch of other murders that Manson committed, Hell's Angels, people like that. and we think the Hell's Angels reference. There's a well at the bottom of the Golar Wash about 4 miles from the Barker Ranch. It's filled in. There's no existence. And I had a longtime local say, check that with your dog. What I did, he alerted. We got good mass spectrometer analysis. And then I had the prison interview all three girls when Susan was alive early in 2008. And she said, oh, these two guys took me back to the Barker Ranch. She left the Barker Ranch to go back down to Los Angeles to get her kid, who was in social services custody. And since those two bikers, you know, those the Charlie and Tex and a couple other guys, they were with guns, and, you know, they were paranoid. And they made me walk up to the Barker Ranch, and I don't know what happened with those two guys. So I think those two guys are down in that well. All we know is that two biker guys from Venice area.
And did Watson finger Manson specifically for any of these murders?
Yes, he said they were committed by Manson. That's what his exact words were. And I think there's a KNBC report where Tom plays that recording of what the attorney Bill Boyd said, and that close to his exact words, but you can listen to it. I think I sent you a link to that, and said, yeah, he told me about a bunch of other murders Manson committed. And so, you know, obviously that's going to be probably at the Barker Ranch. There's probably, there's one in Lynch that we're sure that Tex Watson did, an elderly man. And the witness is still alive. I've interviewed her. And that's
so in total, how many bodies do you believe, based on eyewitness testimony, there are at Barker Ranch? How many bodies?
Well, there's probably at least three at Barker Ranch, but I have one is, you got to understand that these were the people that the information comes from, Manson family members here at the Barker Ranch, who told someone else. One of them is a very reliable guy. He's an author and everything, but he knew this Manson family member since they were a child. And the other ones were two Manson family members who fled up north, and they met up with childhood friends from an orphanage that they all stayed in. They told them about these other murders, two other murders. Yeah, well, possibly three, but we think one guy may have been buried. So there's two guys near the front yard is the bottom line, and one was shot up behind the Barker Ranch in the head. And that guy's exact words, I personally saw Charles Manson shoot a guy in the head with a .45 in a gully behind the Barker Ranch, and that's one of our sites. If he's buried there or it's just blood, I can't tell. But there, the two in the Golden Wash, and then there's a girl. Again, this is coming from a Manson family member to a very reliable guy who's an author and respected, very religious fella, who knew her since she was a little girl. He said there was a girl that wasn't fitting in, and she was freaking out. So Charlie and Tex took her for a walk up towards the Myers Ranch, which is about 400 meters from the Barker Ranch, and they came back without her, and she was never seen again. Well, halfway, there's a trail that goes up there. Halfway between the Barker Ranch and the Myers Ranch, there's a little kind of gully. Or it's a low spot, actually, off the trail, and Buster alert. That was his first alert. So it's exactly where they said this girl disappeared.
And when you say the term alerted means he's found something?
Yes.
Okay. And in each of these spots, whether it's the old well, he alerted on every one of those spots, which would corroborate the eyewitness testimony.
Correct. And we have mass spectrometer analysis from the world's leading expert on human decomposition from all those sites that are positive.
And then we have, if that's not enough, we have these tapes that Tex Watson's lawyer recorded, some 20 hours of tapes. The LAPD knows about them, but they can't
now,
get
now
they,
about, they, I should say about 14 hours of those tapes were used to write his book.
Okay.
So the 6 hours of tapes were the ones no one's ever heard. So Tom tried to get those for many years and finally told the LADA's office and LAPD, and they went down there with a warrant to try to get them, but the judge already said they couldn't, and so they really made the judge very unhappy.
Because the tapes are in Texas. They're tied up in bankruptcy court or something?
They were in bankruptcy court, but now they did get them. The law, because Bill Boyd died about 6 months after, and so they were in probate. And
okay.
So they have them. They won't let us listen to them. And what they're saying, LAPD's got a new rule on dealing with the press. They can lie off the record, but they can't lie on the record.
All right, listen, I'll get you to hold on, Paul. We'll take a timeout. Otis Redding takes us into the break, back with more of our conversation with Paul Dosti about his incredible dog, Buster. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM.